It's time to get nerdy, y'all.
A little bit of gaming history for you.
Something relevant in gaming and discuss our opinions on it.
Should we kick it out of here or should we kickstart it?
This is the part where you, the listeners, try to stump the hosts.
I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, lads and lasses of all ages, welcome to the show. It is Monday, March 23rd, 2026, and it is time to get nerdy. Welcome to episode 373 of Two Nerds in a Pod, the nerdiest gaming podcast in the multiverse. I am Mac, and I am joined by my friend, my co-host, my pal, and confidant, Mr. Lom Galuka, but we also know him as Mr. Nice Guy 425. And for the next hour, we're going to cover topics ranging from game news all the way to trivia and lawsuits and everything in between as they relate to our favorite art form, video games. But Mr. Nice Guy, it's been a couple of weeks since we've been able to get together. How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. Nothing exciting has really happened. I was supposed to be traveling last week, and we just had a huge snowstorm here in the Midwest and really across the country.
That sounds exciting.
It was, I mean, it meant that I had to be here instead of somewhere sunny.
Brum, brum,
but
brum.
It did mean, as a positive, I got to hang out with the family and not travel and have to deal with the things that come with traveling. So that was good. You know what, Mac? I don't have a ton of exciting stuff to share other than like playing some really, really cool new games. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about that later. What is new with you, man?
What to talk about? I think just the quick notes is probably that that last week we had a couple of guests on. And it's the first time in a while that I've done a recording in the meat space rather than over the interwebs. It's always going to be different than how things were back in the early days of the show when we lived in the same town.
Sure.
But it was fun to get a sort of, two nerds style experience, with somebody else in the same room. It was a good time last week. And I learned an awful lot about The Sims that I had no idea about before. So apart from that, Mr. Nice Guy, just sort of normal stuff, keeping my head above water, trying to watch some cool things, read good books, and play awesome games.
I want to hear if you've picked anything up in the Steam sale or if you're eyeing anything, but I also don't want to ruin what we've been watching and what we've been playing for later. So is that a question you can answer or no? Or have you just not picked up anything? Because we all have huge backlogs.
I have picked up a couple of things. One I played through and one I haven't yet but intend on. And that is the Resident Evil 3 remake.
Okay.
Was on sale for a tidy discount on the store. I debated about the Resident Evil 4 remake, but I'm just not quite ready there. So I figured Resident Evil 3.
I have never played a Resident Evil game,
never.
Other than maybe like 5 or 10 minutes when I think Raccoon City was available on demo.
Mm-hmm.
Which one would you recommend, number one? Like if I was like, hey, I want to try this series out, would you say 4? What would you say?
Do you prefer a game that is like survival action or survival horror?
Probably survival action, huge Last of Us fan over here.
Then I would say Resident Evil 5 is a good spot because Resident Evil 5 is a lot more action-y, but also you have an AI companion who's with you the whole time and is pretty darn competent. And also you have the option to do it co-op with somebody else. So that really, I think, takes a lot of the edge off of the survival aspect and a lot more in the action-y thing because you can help each other out and be helped out. It just feels more like a struggle you can win and not a, oh, I've got to run.
Well, I tell you this, man. I like the idea of an AI companion because AI just makes everything more efficient, right? I think that's something we can all agree on. So I'll definitely have to check out Resident Evil 5. Thanks for the recommendation.
Yeah. It's good stuff. And I'd be happy to play it co-op with you.
Mac didn't even get the little jab about AI that I just threw in.
Oh,
there.
I did. I just chose not to acknowledge it. But now that we're here, yeah. I do think you would enjoy Resident Evil 5, though, because it really is that sort of solid transition from survival horror where you don't have enough ammo to survival action where you do have to have enough ammo, but you just have to be a little careful about it.
I like it.
And I think those are fundamentally different experiences, but still good.
Nice. One shout out that I got to give on Steam sale, Fallout New Vegas is 99 cents for the base game on the Steam sale. So if you like RPGs, if you like Fallout, if you like Bethesda, if you like cheap games, that is a steal. Even if you don't get the Ultimate Edition, $1 for the base game. Check that out. And Mac, on that note, I say we do what we do best and hop right up in that gaming news, my friend. What do you think?
Absolutely, Mr. Nice Guy. I'm so woefully out of the loop, but I know big things are happening all the time. What is new in video gaming?
So much. And let's start with this story on PCGamer.com, written by Lincoln Carpenter. Here is what Lincoln writes. Earlier today, Capcom pushed its summary of a February 2026 online investor information session. Asked during the briefing to detail its plans for AI usage in game development, Capcom said it won't use game assets generated by AI, but intends to actively use generative AI to improve its development workflows. Quote, we will not incorporate assets generated by AI into our game I'm not going to read the quote. It literally says the same thing I just read. But it goes on to say Capcom said it's currently evaluating potential applications of generative AI technologies across various disciplines, including graphics, sound, and programming, which is interesting. Thinking specifically about graphics, sounds, and programming, and the ability to use AI to improve efficiencies, we all know your take previously on AI in gaming. Is it softening as we see more and more people using it not to replace humans, but to potentially make life easier?
I don't know of any company, especially in the light of how many of these very companies have announced large layoffs, are necessarily using AI to supplement rather than to supplant parts of their payroll. I don't think that there is evidence for that assertion that AI is not being implemented to get rid of people. I think the evidence points in the opposite direction, but, you know, I mean, reasonable people can disagree.
And I'm one of those reasonable people. Like, here's my thing. I don't know that we have an example where we can say these layoffs were the direct result of people using AI. I think we have plenty of examples of people being laid off because of lack of profitability or because of people not taking sunken costs into account, right? We start working on a game and we say, you know what? This is going to end up being a way bigger project over the next 5 years than we thought it would be. So we're going to abandon the game and we're going to maybe let some people go. But I don't know that I have seen examples of people losing their jobs to computers, at least in the AI space.
Sure. I think Microsoft itself is a pretty solid example. They have talked about how they are primarily vibe coding on the new Windows operating system, as opposed to actually, you know, employing the programmers. I wouldn't say it's been super well documented, because obviously, I think anything that's embarrassing, most of these companies do a pretty good job of trying to keep a tamp down on. You know, you signed an NDA. I think that the fact that we get so much push in AI, and that on any company, beyond anything else, the largest expenditure is payroll. I can't think of a single company where payroll is not the biggest expenditure. And if there is anything to streamline by using AI, that's the biggest spot to cut. Like I said, reasonable people can disagree, but I don't think it's reasonable to think that the cuts will come from anywhere else before they try and cut their largest component.
All right, so not to get like too much into the your argument is inconsistent.
Yeah, no, get into it, man. Come on.
But it is inconsistent, because a minute ago it was, oh, there's plenty of examples of AI making people lose their jobs. And then after that it was, well, Microsoft hasn't really documented it well, because that would be embarrassing. So you're already backpedaling. Go ahead, please.
Allow me to clarify, Mr. Nice Guy. I am not prepared to quote chapter and verse, because I am not I'm not the type of person that keeps those notes to hand when I prep for history crowdfunding and legalese.
Fair, fair. Okay, that's fair.
I know what I have heard, but also at the top of the show, I say almost every time, I am out of the loop. I don't really drill down very much on news.
Fair.
So, like, all I can tell you is the sort of vague amorphous that I've heard things about Microsoft bragging about how much of Windows is now vibe-coded and not even touched. Like, they're like, whole sections of our code are completely written by, I think Claude is the name of their in-house AI. Whole sections of Windows operating system are written by Claude, and none, and we're not even touching it. At the same time, like a week later, they'll be like, we've also let, you know, 40,000, 50,000 programmers go. And I can't help but see how those things couldn't be related, but I'm just not prepared with chapter and verse. However,
And I would I won't call you out on that. I would need a specific example, but I won't call you out on that. Because you're right. We kind of come and we improvise a little bit.
Yeah, we do. We do. This is back and forth. And that's why I'm always willing to say reasonable people will disagree. However, if we do ever do that long promised AI centric episode and we know we want to go head to head in the Thunderdome, I promise I will bring my preparations for just such a conversation. But I am not prepared in such a way.
It's not going to matter, though. It's not going to matter because I'll just write my arguments using AI and I'll win.
Funny you should say that. I just want us to put a pin in that comment. I love you. We are going to come back to that.
I wouldn't really do that, but that was just me being silly in terms of writing my arguments with AI. But hey, I do have like 2 points I want to make on this topic.
Yeah, please.
Number one, you talked about how the largest expenditure potentially is payroll, and I would agree with you.
I'm sure there is a company that payroll is not the biggest expenditure, but I mean, I've seen the balance sheets of quite a few companies, and I can't think of any company for which payroll's not the biggest.
Sure, and I would say that improving efficiencies, right? Not talking about art, not talking about voice acting, improving efficiency would clearly decrease the amount of hours that people are required to work, and would potentially cut down on the amount of crunch that is required for game studios come crunch time, which would then decrease payroll bills.
Now,
so it doesn't necessarily mean that people need to be fired or that they need to be laid off, but it could potentially cut back on some of those required overtime hours that people are working as they're troubleshooting, as they're grinding, as they're spending time away from their families to get games done. So I think that we solve the problem you've mentioned, not through firing, but by cutting back on hours.
So half of a layoff rather than a full layoff by cutting back hours.
Well, no, it's people keeping their jobs but not having to work, you know, 80 hours in a week, which still cuts back on payroll.
You see, I just there's a thing, and maybe this just comes to a fundamental assumption that I've made in economics. They used to talk about the productivity of workers has increased over the years. And economists have like GDP per labor hour or whatever. But in spite of that kind of efficiency from a, you know, what has been produced standpoint, early economists would say things like, hey, by the year 1990, we'll be efficient enough that we'll produce so much with our labor hours that everybody can work a 4-hour work week. Or things like that. There's like, you know, through history, people talk a lot about we won't have to work more. And I just feel like that never seems to come to pass. Either the we don't crunch because we don't have to work harder. I just feel like the lesson that some people take from that is we need fewer people and then we just crunch those last few people harder at the end. But I don't know. I don't have good data on it. I think neither of us have good data on it, and I think that comes down to some of the trade secrets.
Well, and I'm not suggesting that we need less people. I'm suggesting we keep the same people and work them less. And that could potentially come through efficiencies that AI could provide. But I have a couple questions for you I'd like to ask.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to ask these in a non-leading way, and then we can share other news stories if we have time. Mac, what would you say is your favorite part of this podcast, of doing this podcast?
Of spending time with you.
I would agree. Hanging out,
yeah.
The recording, the pre-show, the post-show, the camaraderie. To me, that is my favorite part of doing this podcast and why we still do it.
Yeah.
Now, what would you say is your least favorite part of this podcast?
Is probably editing.
Yes. Now, I didn't plan this at all, but it's possible, Mac, that the editing aspect of the podcast could be replaced by AI. That AI could be programmed over time to do that part of the podcast and take it off of your plate. And then the part that you really enjoy, that human factor of hanging out, of recording, of our voices coming together to make this awesome thing that is award-winning.
Multi-award-winning, a dynasty.
Is the only thing we have to do. And Mac, I'm sure you can see where I'm going with this, but that's just my point about game production, is the parts that people really enjoy, the passionate part, the human element that cannot and should not be replaced by a robot, could continue. But the I won't call them redundancies, but the quote-unquote busy work, the troubleshooting, the finding bugs, those things could be stopped by AI, and it would cut the time down significantly. We record for an hour. You edit for how long each episode?
Well, more than an hour.
That's all I have to say about that. I would drop the mic, but this mic is expensive.
Yeah.
Would you like to say anything in response, Mac?
Sure.
I feel like that was a brilliant thing that I just did.
Lom, all due respect, you are a smart, clever, you are also hilarious and my buddy. And I love doing this show. And the editing is my least favorite part. If I could have somebody else do it, I would be very tempted. I will say, though, that I think editing is a complex thing, and I wouldn't want to let somebody else do it for the reason that when you edit, you gain an appreciation for how much you can change something in editing. Like, how much you can edit a clip to make somebody sound like they aren't clever, or how you can make somebody sound like they're being mean. And
sure.
And any number of things can happen in the edit. And I really, really would have to have an insane amount of trust in not just an AI, but in another person. And where AI, as a large language model, these things are, they are trained on data. And the way that we do things, this human expression that you and I are doing right here, the edit is also an expression. I would be worried about even an AI or even another person who came in editing and then the show feeling different, maybe in subtle ways, but in what was it we were on about, like not us, but like the dudes of the internet were on about, like the Snyder cut of the Justice League or whatever.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Editing is an artistic expression, and you can do a lot in the edit, and I would never really want to offload that side of things, as tempting as it would be because it takes a lot of time. It is still an artistic expression, and I think important to keep in-house, if you will.
Dude, the Snyder Cut analogy, brilliant. I would not have expected that. I thought about this. I was like, dude, I'm going to ask him two questions. I'm not going to lead him in. I know what he's going to say, and then I'm going to destroy him. But that Snyder Cut analogy is a killer, killer point. So I have to admit,
you've got killer questions.
Yeah, right. Well, hey, you know what? I don't think any other news story is quite as cool as this one was. So that's been our news for the week.
Mr. Nice Guy, thank you for that lovely conversation. So firmly rooted in the here and now. But I would like to take you on a little trip into the past to some gaming highlights from this last week and years before. Nice Guy, I have a couple of games, a handful of games that I think are really awesome and would encourage you, if you haven't, and of course anybody else, to play them. Some of them mean a little something to me. Some of them might to you as well. Mr. Nice Guy, I'm going to start with one of the more recent titles, and I'm going to work my way farther back, starting in 2022. I know it's not that historical, but I think we can agree that the game Tunic has a lot of historicity to it. Have you played it?
Yeah, I have played Tunic, and it's a great, great game. Has Legend of Zelda vibes.
Yeah.
A lot of charm. Mm-hmm. And doesn't hold your hand. I love it.
One of the things that I especially loved about Tunic was they do this thing where as you're moving through the world, you discover things through a, you know, sort of meta narrative given to you in a game manual. You collect pages of the game manual and you discover stuff that you could have always done, like controls that were existent, but that you don't know until you get it there. And we're going to spoil just a little bit, but Mr. Nice Guy, did you figure out any of those D-pad button codes to spawn items?
Dude, I did not, no.
Oh my gosh. So encoded on the game's pages, you know, there's a lot of like secrets and ways to beat puzzles. But one of the things that it gives you at some point in time, kind of hidden in the margins, is that you can do a button code in order to like give yourself some bombs.
Really?
And it'll just like spawn in like a few bombs. And it is absolutely a thing that the devs intended. And then there's so many secrets and things hidden. And I've got to admit, I've beaten the game. And there are still some things that are taking my head for a spin about the lore and everything about it. But like, absolutely loved Tunic. And it kept me company on a train ride back from your house. So of course I'm going to have fond feelings about it. It reminds me of time spent together, even if it's just on the far end.
I like it.
Well, in keeping with a game that I purchased on the Steam sale, Mr. Nice Guy, the Resident Evil 3 remake came out for modern systems in 2020. I'll have more to say about that eventually, because I have not played Resident Evil 3. So playing the Resident Evil 3 remake is going to be the first experience through the game. So I'm looking forward to it. Nice Guy, you had a great time with It Takes Two. I believe, did you play it with...
Played it with Spenis.
With Spenis.
Yeah, we didn't play the whole game, but we played a lot.
It was a good experience, but there are some games that they made beforehand, including a game called A Way Out, released in 2018 this last week. It is nowhere near as good as It Takes Two. There's definitely a reason why A Way Out didn't really get nominated for awards like It Takes Two did. But in it, you're breaking out a lot of similar ideas of two people who are working together and need to beat the puzzles or do the things as a team. But you're breaking out of prison and then trying to stop a, you know, drug cartel guy. So it's definitely different, way more serious. However, you know, very similar style mechanics. And I played it after playing It Takes Two, so it was definitely a thing where I'm like, oh, I can see where the idea came from. As different of a genre it is,
yep,
you can kind of clearly see this like pedigree and the evolution of the idea until the nigh unto perfection of it in It Takes Two. And then, Nice Guy, just one last game. 1994, Castlevania Bloodlines for the Sega Genesis. Have you played it?
Dude, yeah, I've played it.
You've played Bloodlines?
I've played it on emulation. Yeah, in fact, I have it on my analog pocket. Yeah.
Dude, I think Castlevania Bloodlines might have one of the best soundtracks in the Castlevania franchise. I think it's so good.
Better than like classic NES?
Yeah. And I really think it's a result of the composer that they brought on for Bloodlines. Is just, she's incredible. She's done some of the best music in the franchise, but I really think she pulled out all the stops for Bloodlines. And then on top of that, the Sega Genesis had sound chips in the console that were made by Yamaha, which of course at the time, Yamaha not only had like motorcycles and such, but their bread and butter was music synthesizers and keyboards.
Sure. Yeah.
So like, you know, especially in the era, in the time, if you knew how to make those Yamaha chips sing, you could make those things sing. And I think she did just an incredible job of it. Now, gameplay-wise, I definitely don't think Bloodlines is the best. I think there's a lot left on the table, a lot to be desired. But I think definitely the music is brilliant. There's a couple of them that give me chills down my spine every time. But yeah. Anyway.
Nice.
Mr. Nice Guy. That's what I had for history this week. And to all of you listeners, if for any reason you're looking for some games to play, all of those are fantastic choices. And maybe you should add those to your list.
I like it, Mac. I like it a lot. And I don't know if people knew this. There's actually a Castlevania game set to come out in 2026 on Steam and probably other platforms as well. I just added it to my wish list the other day because it looked really, really good.
Is it a Castlevania game done by Motion Twin, done by the Dead Cells dudes?
I think so, because it looked a lot like Dead Cells. Yeah.
And yeah, it's on my wish list too.
Nice. Well, dude, we'll have to review it when it comes out. That'd be fun.
Absolutely.
Well, Mac, now it is time for our next segment called Topic of the Week, a segment where we discuss something relevant in gaming and give our opinions on it. And Mac, this one is, it's one of those questions where it could go two directions. It could be like, let people play how they want to play. Or it could be, get off my lawn with this crap, right? And I'm excited to hear your perspective and how you feel. This is on Kotaku.com, written by John Walker. Here is what John writes. Shopping on the PlayStation Store might be a slightly less daunting experience today, after Sony wiped over 1,000 shovelware games released by two different companies. It's the second time the console owner has performed such a sweeping cleanup this year. Every console store has been plagued by the presence of low-quality games in recent times, including PlayStations. It makes the stores incredibly frustrating to use for players, where coming soon and new release pages can be overwhelmed by half-baked $2.99 nonsense, with interesting indie games and even big new titles hard to find. It results in customers defaulting to sponsored sections or curated sections, etc., etc. So it says, it's very welcome to see Sony being so proactive about swinging the ban broom. But here's the thing it says next, Mech, and this is where it really gets interesting. The flood of releases isn't really about tricking average players into shelling out cash on garbage, although that's part of it, but more about seeking the attention of trophy hunters. These churned out games come bulging with super simple trophies to collect, making it very easy to get a platinum. This is then exacerbated by releasing the games as so-called stacks, where there are multiple regional versions of the same game, each with their own set of trophies to collect. So those 1,000 deletions are, in fact, closer to around 100 actual games, each released multiple times. Mac, I know that's kind of wordy and kind of written interesting, but did that all make sense? Should I summarize what's going on here?
Yeah, I hope you'd help me out just a little bit, because I'm familiar with, like, achievements, but I've never really, well, not since the networking days, I haven't really had much in the way of Sony consoles. So, like, how do these trophy stacks, you know, how does that work?
Yeah, so achievements, trophies, effectively the same thing by a different name. Okay. But on PlayStation, if you collect every trophy for a game, you get what's called a platinum. Mm-hmm. It increases your quote-unquote gamer score of your profile. It increases the prestige. It's kind of a bragging right to be able to say I have platinums. So these $2.99, these 99-cent shovelware games, where sometimes you could even get a platinum in like 2 minutes just by playing the game, are something that a lot of people have started to put out so that people can get platinums, and Sony has just gotten rid of them. I want to hear your thoughts generally.
Well, real quick follow-up on the platinums.
Yeah.
If platinum increases your gamer score, is there anything that is beyond the gate of, say, a 100,000 platinum score, or beyond the gate of 100 platinums?
Meaning, can you get more than 100 platinums? And
is there any... What's the goal, aside from just a type of hollow bragging right?
Oh. That's it. There may be some other small perks, but for the most part, it's just a bragging thing. It's like a digital badge when you get a trophy, when you get a platinum.
Gotcha. So the gamer equivalent of, and then the whole bus clapped.
Yeah, exactly. Slow clapped, if you will.
I can definitely see how people would find this behavior frustrating. You work really hard to have platinum in something, and then somebody's got 10 platinums that they did in 5 minutes. However, I don't know as that would frustrate me so much that I would be demanding to have these trophy stacks removed and swept off the store. But I can see how some people would be happy with it. I also don't know as to just how very much someone will feel like it has degraded their achievement as well. So I don't know. I find it curious. I can definitely see where somebody is coming from, but I have no strong feelings on it. And it seems more than a little bizarre to me. Nice guy. Do you feel like these low effort trophy stacks people are stacking up is, you know, making you look bad?
It doesn't make me look bad because I'm not really a trophy hunter. And by the way, I know I said gamer score earlier.
Yeah.
Guys and girls, I know that gamer score is on Xbox, right? I completely.
Yeah. He's trying to explain it to this dum-dum over here who needs that kind of information. Okay. That's a for me thing, not for you. Get over yourself.
Relax. Exactly. Relax. So it's interesting, some of the comments that we're getting in the chat. So G said, where did he say it? He said, why can't Sony, Microsoft, Epic, Valve, etc. just police their own storefronts? How do these frauds get their games on the store? Do they even have QA/QC? That's a good question. And I'd imagine that there is some level of quality control. But I also think that the requirements to get on there are just pretty loose. You probably pay a fee to get on there, and maybe they keep a certain percentage of your sales. But now they're saying, no, we want our system to be more pure in terms of the score. Here are my thoughts. I really don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I care more about the store being muddled up, I believe was the phrase, by all of this crap that's on there, making it hard to browse the store. But if people really, really feel that their score matters so much that they want to spend $2.99 and 99 cents on games, more power to them. To me, if I see someone has 100 platinums, I'm looking at the games, and then they get my quote-unquote e-respect based on that.
E-respect, I like that.
I would never do this. I feel like it's a waste of time and waste of money. It's like beating my kids in basketball. Like, that's not a waste of time. But I don't take so much pride in it at this point because they are young that I'm going and bragging to my friends about it. I liken this to the same type of thing. Mac, my other question for you, though, is how do you feel about the effect this would have on some of these game developers that have effectively built a brand around putting this type of content out?
So we do call this kind of stuff shovelware, right?
Sure.
You know, something that you're just shoveling in that you haven't put much love into. I kind of feel worried about somebody's sincere effort not being good and being mistaken for low effort, because it takes time. Nobody comes to the table with all of the coding expertise of a Nintendo studio, with the design expertise, or, you know, with code like Nicholas, with mechanics like Nicholas, with music like Nicholas, except for maybe Nicholas, you know, guy who made Cave Story.
Right, solo, all by himself.
Exactly. Rare is the solo dev who has it all locked down from the start. Most of us really have to struggle and put out stuff that isn't good until we can get there. I think back on the first 300 episodes of this show and how very bad I was at editing. Still am pretty bad at editing.
Nonsense.
And bad at research and such. But, like, we have honed a craft. We have, you know, experimented with things, and we've grown over time. And I would hate for this type of a thing where whatever type of metric they're using to sweep off things, getting in the way or discouraging somebody from sticking with a passion and making something good eventually as they get together experience. And so, I mean, I just worry about the innocent person being swept up in the greater purge, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. It's kind of like when the old Xbox is named in such a complicated way that grandma can't tell the difference between that and the new Xbox, right? And then they get suckered into making the wrong purchase. I don't know that that's the bigger concern. I think that browsing is more the thing.
Yeah, it is objectively tough when there's a lot of stuff. You know, it's hard to cut through the noise.
I guess, and we don't have time to dive too deep into it. If these people didn't violate the terms of service, I have a problem with Sony just sweeping and taking all of their stuff down.
Yeah.
Because they effectively built a brand based on following the rules, ethical or not, you know, quality content or not, and they put all this stuff out. Now Sony is changing their tune. So I'd be interested to dive deeper and see what precedent they use to justify this action. But at the same time, you know, trophies are trophies, you know? You should have had better rules in the beginning.
Well, hey, if there is anybody who listens to this show and either is or knows somebody who maybe has had their game swept off the place, the Sony store in this most recent bit, you know, maybe put them in touch with us. I think it would be an interesting thing to talk about that. And, you know, we love having guests. So open invitation, reach out. You know how to get in touch with us.
Awesome. And that has been our topic of the week.
All right, well, now we turn to a crowdfunding project that is trying to get off of the ground. We call this, of course, Kick or Kickstart. This is a little game called Dark Lord's Tower. What is it? It is a roguelite tower defense game, but made in a sort of vertical fashion. In most tower defense games, you've usually got like a big battlefield, right? And you might, put out some turrets to shoot things as they come round, or traps to catch them as they're going. This one, there is a tower that continually builds upward, expanding. And your task is to keep you're kind of one of the baddies. You're trying to keep the townspeople and the adventurers from messing with your nefarious plans. Constructing the floors as you go and leading the people on through. You're the daughter of the Dark Lord, here to bring him back, but it takes time, and that's what we need to defend and hold the line for so that we can do that. Now, this game, they are asking for $5,000 to bring it to light. They have already smashed past that, hitting 13K so far. And if you are interested, the bare minimum backing would be $13 in order to get a digital copy of the game on release. They're expecting to release in 2026. Obviously, I am a fan of pixel art, which this has. I am a big fan of the tower defense genre. So this checks a lot of boxes for me. But Mr. Nice Guy, I just wanted to see anything stand out to you in this. I know it's your first time seeing it.
Yeah, there's a few things that stand out. First of all, it looks cool. I like the graphics, just like you said. Cave Blazers, a game that was gifted to me and maybe to you as well by Ishmobile. It seems like this really reminds me of that in some ways. Additionally, a card game I was about to play this weekend that someone had gifted me called Boss Monster. Similar premise, where you're playing as the villain, trying to stop the heroes, or in this case, the townspeople, from getting in. I think this is something that's not a new idea, but something that looks like it's executed really well here. Mac, here's my thing. As we've done these Kickstarters for several hundred episodes, I'm starting to realize that when these funds get the minimum, when these funding products get the minimum, or not much more than the minimum, they just don't have enough to actually come out successfully. And if you think about it this way, if someone says that they have enough money to buy, I don't know, a $300,000 house, and they have exactly enough to buy a $300,000 house, they're going to buy the house, and then they're going to be what's called house poor. They're not going to be able to pay the electrical. They're not going to be able to purchase beds. They just had enough to get by. And it's the same thing with these Kickstarter projects. When Kickstarter projects have a low minimum and maybe they meet it or they just barely beat it, they then find out that there are unexpected expenses. I feel like with a $5,000 minimum, even though they're up to $13,000 raised, I wonder if they have enough to really do what they say they're going to do. And so that concerns me.
I think we've also seen a trend of low minimums, that there is a real effect of people being more likely to back something that has gone past the minimum. And so a lot of people set that lower down in order to encourage people to take the chance on it. Because you might be more likely to do that if you're like, oh, it's funded, so it'll be definitely done. You know, we would also welcome Kickstarter people to tell us about how just how off base we are, and how when you say you can build a game in 5,000, you really do mean it. Which, skepticism aside, though, I want to think that this will have the type of polish and the type of mechanics that they would like for it to have upon release. But yeah, at the very least, you know, with all caveat emptor, with all buyer beware, you know, that comes along with all Kickstarters, this does seem like it's got some good vision, it's got some good ideas, and it seems like it might have some good mechanics as well. So I'm cautiously optimistic, nice guy, that they can go the distance, even with 13,000.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic as well. Shall we vote, Mac?
Absolutely. But first, I do just have to say that I've got that rule that that I will not back your Kickstarter unless you can prove you can bring the pieces together with a playable demo, and they've got one. It is a playtest that you can get into on Steam. I do wish that they had set that higher up. Again, I feel like saying we can try it out, we can get some hands-on time, should be the number one thing before you give us the story, before you give us your stretch goals, before everything. It should be, bam, try it for yourself, join the playtest, or, you know,
yep,
or what have
yep.
you. So if you're interested, you can check it out on Steam, try it out for yourself, and see if it works. All right, time to vote. Mr. Nice Guy, I say kickstart.
Yeah, I say kickstart, and the only reason that I will kickstart this or recommend that it be kickstarted is because it's coming out in 2026, right? Like, if it was a year or two out, I would say, nope, absolutely not. 13,000 isn't going to get them there and allow them to pay themselves. Mm. But I like this, and I think they'll do it.
Yeah. I think maybe the term is short enough that they can do it under that. Obviously, we wish everybody the best, but we are impressed with Dark Lord's Tower, and hopefully that 13,000 is enough for this indie team to take it across the finish line.
Well, now it's time for Nerdflex
Woohoo,
a segment where you, the viewers, try to stump the hosts. Sometimes you do, sometimes you do not. If you're here live, you know how this works. You have a job to do. Get a multiple choice gaming related question in the chat. Mac and I will do our best, using nothing but our noggins, to try to answer that question, and we'll see how it goes. From a friend of the show, AlexMan47, check out his Twitch stream. I was hanging out in there a week ago, and it was really good. AlexMan asks, how many minigames in total are in the three N64 Mario Party games combined? A, 110, B, 155, C, 185, or D, 200.
So I was really, really bad at the Mario Party games, like frighteningly bad. I have no real conception as to the answer. And I just used my calculator, and none of those answers are easily dividable by three, which would have triggered for me to discount one of them.
Sure.
If, you know, I would have just been like odd man out. But 200 seems too round of a number. As with 110, I'm leaning toward B or C, and I think I'm personally leaning more toward B, but that is just a sheer shot in the dark.
I had the same thought, because I don't think that there was a uniform amount of games. Obviously, there wasn't, right? Because none of them are divisible by three. So
yeah,
it's interesting because I actually leaned towards the extremes at first.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, but you're right. 200 seems like a lot. That's what, 65 or so games, mini games for each game. So I think you're right. I think we go with B. It's not too crazy, and you know, it's not too small either. B, final answer.
All right, let's see. The answer is C. So we were close. Our thought process was good. Mario Party 1 has 50 mini games. Mario Party 2 has 65, and Mario Party 3 has 70 mini games. It's nice to see that kind of improvement, that they get more and more varied as the time goes. I will say, for extra credit, Alex, man, what is your favorite minigame in the Mario Party, the three Mario Parties for N64?
Let us know. Well, cool, Mac. Next question. I'm sure you'll know the answer to this one. This is from our test bank. It's a first-person shooter question. How many successful kills must a player get to be rewarded a tactical nuke in Modern Warfare 2?
You see, this is funny because Lom knows full well that I've never played Modern Warfare 2. I'm going to guess 10?
Well, here's the thing. A nuke, I'll tell you this. A nuke ends the game.
Oh.
So if you get this number of kills in a row, it completely ends the match and you blow everything up.
Okay, then I revise my number up to 20.
Yeah, exactly. And I know it's either 25 or 30, but I can't remember which. I actually think it's 25. I'm so frustrated that I can't remember.
It's not a multiple choice. We don't have to be unified. Tell you what, if you think 25 and 30, I will revise up to 25.
Okay, and I'll do 30. That's not cheating. That's smart. All right, final answer is locked in. It is indeed 25 kills.
Nice guy. Thank you. We could not have done that without you. I would have been a sucker on 10.
We are indeed 1-4-2. All right, so let's do one more question. All right, this is a Rockstar game. A Rockstar question, rather.
So what? I'm still a Rockstar.
Still a Rockstar. Party Lego Rockstar. Which game does the player find themselves preventing Phil Collins from being assassinated? I did not know this was in a game, a Rockstar game. Which game does the player find themselves preventing Phil Collins from being assassinated?
I know Rockstar for the Grand Theft Auto franchise, so I'm leaning toward that. But that sounds more like a Hitman game. But I don't think Hitman
is... Yeah, those aren't Rockstar, though.
Yeah. It's definitely not any of the Red Dead Redemptions.
Definitely
so,
not.
I'm going to say GTA 3.
I do think it's a GTA, and I think it's probably like a satirical Phil Collins, right? Now, to your point, I'm trying to think like when Phil Collins, not that he's not relevant now, but when he would have been most relevant as GTA games were released. And I think you're
let's
right.
Let's see, when Tarzan, the Disney animated Tarzan came out, that's the peak of Phil Collins's relevancy.
I'm trying to think if I knew where Phil Collins is from, because I feel like it could be GTA Vice City, which I believe is like Vegas. So you can go GTA 3, I'll go Vice City.
Okay, yeah,
if
let's
you want.
Do it. Yeah.
Oh, man, we were so close. It's actually Vice City Stories.
Oh.
Which is probably, I think, one of the PSP titles. So
I'm going to say, for you saying Vice City, I think that counts.
It's close, but it's not quite the same. So I think we're 1-for-3 today, which is totally cool. That's been Nerdflex.
All right. Well, now we turn to a little bit of legalese.
Legalese.
Mr. Nice Guy, we're going to talk about Fortis Advisors v. Crafton. That's the whole lawsuit around the, you know, around the Subnautica 2.
Yep.
You may or may not have heard a little bit about of it. Anybody who is getting caught up now for the first time, in July of last year, we did a quick short posted between episode 349 and 350 about the legal drama that was then unfolding around the creation and launch of Subnautica 2. Now, in episode 353 for Legalese, we shared an update because Crafton had finally filed their answer to the initial claim. And since then, believe it or not, there has been discovery, depositions, testimony, arguments in court, and a ruling. And that is stupid fast, everybody. I cannot stress this enough. That is crazy fast for a lawsuit. Usually takes on the order of years. Last week, Nice Guy, while I was recording with our guests, I got the notification about this ruling. And I've had a week to look it over, so now I can share with you the 92-page ruling. And sure, that is a lot of pages, but I would encourage everybody to have a read over it, because the first 41 pages are written like a totally easy-to-follow story before they get into the legal analysis. And most of it just entirely quotes sections from depositions, witness testimony, exhibits, emails, and ChatGPT logs. Pin in that, because we're going there. So, Unknown Worlds is a smallish size game dev. They started with just two dudes who made games together. They started making Half-Life mods and moved into building their own first-person shooters. But something I didn't know until reading this is that after the Sandy Hook school shooting, these guys said, you know what, no more shooters, no more FPSs, we're going to make a story and we're going to try and do something that's about exploration and alien planets and the terrors of the deep, and hence Subnautica 1.
Interesting.
They made great use of the early access model, which I think some of our listeners, and even you and I, Nice Guy, we might have some feelings on the early access model, but it is part of what they're known for. So the company grows, Nice Guy. They grows and for Subnautica 2, they want to expand into the overseas market a bit more, punch above their weight. They get outside legal counsel, that's Fortis Advisors, why their name's on the lawsuit, to help with their contracts. And during negotiations with Krafton, which is the South Korean company, Unknown Worlds thinks that they are worth $750 million to be bought out, and Krafton thinks that they're only worth $500 million. And so Unknown Worlds agrees to be bought for $500 million with certain terms. One of those terms is that Krafton leaves them effectively in complete control of the company. And also, to sweeten the pot, Krafton says, hey, if the launch of Subnautica 2 goes well, and you can hit $69 million in sales company-wide during a certain window of time for the release of Subnautica 2, the early access release of Subnautica 2, if you hit $69 million, we will pay you $3.12 for every dollar over that $69 million until we've paid out that extra $250 million that you insisted that you were worth. That item there is information that we only just now learned, because in previous filings, that, like, how they figured what the payout would be, that sort of bonus payout that they would get, was hidden behind redaction bars. But it's public knowledge now. So that was a cool thing. We get some of those. So, all right. So production on Subnautica 2 continues, Mr. Nice Guy. All right. And Krafton starts to get a little bit worried, because their internal projections show that Unknown Worlds is probably going to smash through the earnings projections. They're going to smash through that $69 million, and Krafton is going to have to pay out all $250 million. That's what they are saying internally. And so Krafton's CEO, Mr. Kim, panics and wants to not have to pay out $250 million extra dollars. Everybody tells him, Kim, this is a done deal. We're just going to have to special it up and suck it up, especially the legal department that says, yeah, there's no way out of this. They negotiated a rock solid contract. However, they didn't count on ChatGPT, because Mr. Nice Guy, ChatGPT tells Mr. Kim, the CEO, that he can, in fact, keep it from happening. All he has to do is make a hostile takeover of Unknown Worlds, fire the three people who can get the bonus money, and delay the release so that it can't possibly hit the financial targets in this time window. So, Mr. Kim asks ChatGPT to make a hostile takeover plan for him. ChatGPT does what it does best. It compiles a hostile takeover plan from sample takeover plans that it can see on the internet, and Mr. Kim puts it into action. They lock down the Steam page. They lock down the website, the social medias. They fire the three people at the top and claim that it's all because those greedy studio heads at Unknown Worlds are not respecting the integrity of the game. And we have to fire them to keep Subnautica 2 from launching too early. The lawsuit is filed. All these spicy details come to light and come out during the course of discovery, including the ChatGPT logs where Mr. Kim asks the AI assistant to create these plans and says, no, you're wrong, ChatGPT. There must be a way that we can do this. And ChatGPT says, you're right, Mr. Kim. Of course we can do this. We've just got to get creative. Now, the judge finds that Krafton needs to bring back one of those three dudes that they fired, the one who was studio lead, and they say, you have to step the heck away, and the judge expands the revenue window by the time frame that Krafton mucked about and messed up all of the things by trying to lock things down. Which leads us to the very unique opportunity we have, Mr. Nice Guy. Because, just in case anybody was wondering, if you wanted to, I don't know, spite purchase an early access copy of Subnautica 2, every dollar that you spend past that revenue window is costing Krafton $3.12 into the pockets of Unknown Worlds. So, you've got the opportunity to do something really funny. But that's not legal advice, and it's not ChatGPT, but it is legalese. Mr. Nice Guy, I have a funny accounting footnote, though.
What's that?
There's an interesting thing that I saw on page 30, particularly footnote 171, that's very interesting. It references Mr. Kim's contemporaneous notes and his testimony of him saying that if the payout happens, that it would, quote, significantly reduce the studio's book value, end quote. So I'm not a CEO or anything, but I have kept the books for some companies before. And it's been my experience, unless they do something very differently over in South Korea, it's been my experience that paying out a liability that you have incurred doesn't drop the book value. Putting the liability on your books drops the book value. So any damage done to book value is when you take on the liability, like when you have the car loan or the bank loan. That's when your book value decreases, not when you pay it off or pay it out. But then again, this guy did think it was a good idea to deny the advice of professional legal counsel and literally everyone around him and say, yes, ChatGPT, you know better than everybody else in this high-stakes situation. So maybe he just doesn't understand that what liabilities are. However, if I had stock in Krafton, I would be asking for an investigation into CEO Mr. Kim to make sure that he isn't cooking the books, because it sure sounds like he admitted to cooking the books.
It's interesting. I have thoughts, but we don't have time.
Well, it's our show, Mr. Nice Guy. We got all the time in the world. But we do have work tomorrow.
Yeah, I do. But stories like these make you want to support the devs, right?
Yeah.
So, like, support
but
the devs.
Any dollar that you spend is also kind of supporting Krafton too, right? It feels a little catch-22, right?
It does, but I'm more saying generally. Because here's the thing, Mac.
Yeah.
Many places where you spend money, you're going to be supporting someone who you don't like. Mm. You're just oblivious to it, right? If you get a burger at McDonald's, I'm sure you're supporting someone who has deplorable views, who is a deplorable person who you just don't like. So at some point, I've learned to draw the line between saying, hey, I want to support this person, without also saying, but I don't want to support that person in the same transaction. Because it's just not a feasible way of living. So yeah, support the devs, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Support indie devs, support the studios that you believe deserve your dollar and purchase. Maybe don't just get the Game Pass version, but go out and buy the version of their game that's going to put the most money in their pockets, because you never know, they could be fired, they could be laid off the next day.
Absolutely. And we do know at least that for a certain range of time, every game copy does cost Krafton a little bit more. So if you feel like being vindictive, That's your opening.
There it is. Well, hey, thank you for tuning into the show, everybody. This has been a fun one. I really liked the AI discussion, liked the legalese. Dope episode. I'm excited. Before we go, we have one last segment called What We've Been Watching and What We've Been Playing, where we talk about just that, the cool, nerdy stuff we've been into across all platforms. And with the Steam sale going on, super excited to hear what people are purchasing or eyeing in the Steam sale. Let us know in the chat if you are interested. And Mac, what you been into?
So I've been playing Stardew Valley, I've been playing some GURPS, some D&D, my usual stuff. But in the Steam sale, I picked up a thing called Museum of Mechanics Lockpicking. And essentially, it is a, you know, video game 3D museum hall that in it has all these lockpicking minigames reproduced from other things. So it's got lockpicking from Oblivion. It's got lockpicking from early D&D games, like the D&D video games. It's got lockpicking from Mass Effect. And, you know, all these sorts of things that it's just reproduced to the hacking interface. It's not an especially robust video game itself, but it was really interesting to essentially walk through this museum and see an evolution of a mini game being presented as a thing. It was a delightful experience. It worked on my Steam Deck, although I did have to, it didn't exactly map perfectly, so I had to do a little bit of fiddling to get the mapping right, but yeah, it was hashtag worth it, and a fun little trip down memory lane, lockpicking mechanics I had tried before, some that I had never, so that was really cool. Also, nice guy, I've been watching through the Miyazaki films. I basically had only ever seen one Miyazaki film ever, and that was Princess Mononoke. But now I've seen Porco Rosso, Ponyo, Spirited Away, My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service, and we're just going through all of them. So it's fun. I've slept on Miyazaki for so long. I'm excited to be filling in that bit in my nerd cred.
Love it.
How about you, dude? What have you been up to?
Dude, so much. Probably the highlight in terms of content I've been consuming is I've been reading a lot.
Nice.
And I just finished, I won't say I just finished, but between the last time we recorded and now, I finished Golden Sun, which is the second book in the Red Rising series. And I have since started the third book, Morningstar, which is Morningstar? Morningsun? Yeah, Morningstar, I believe it's called. And it's a super good book.
Nice.
So really enjoying that, listening to Project Hail Mary on Audible, and was hoping to have it done before the movie came out. That did not happen, so eventually I'll go see the movie. I heard it's pretty good. As far as gaming, Mac, I picked up a couple things on the Steam sale. One was Ark Raiders, which I had on PS5, but wanted to be able to play it handheld. And the other is Slay the Spire, which I had always heard so much about. But I've been starting to get more into board games, deck building stuff, researched mm-hmm. that game. It's like $5 something cents, because I already owned Balatro and they had a bundle where you could get both of those games. It's amazing. Slay the Spire, definitely a Maction game, probably an Alex Mann game, probably not a Galvatron game, but check it out. Phenomenal game. Well, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in to episode 373 of Two Nerds in a Pod. We appreciate you being here, hanging out, and enjoying our video game therapy session every week,
mm-hmm.
Mondays on twitch.tv/twonerdsinapod. We appreciate y'all. Have a good week and be excellent to each other. Play games.
Bye.